The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hi, thank you all for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Jerry Kane, who has agreed to be interviewed with us today. I'm Lee Green, and I run IRI's Strategic Initiatives. This interview is an element of IRI's Digital Transformation Community. The DXC is a community of organizations that are on the journey toward digital transformation. And through the DXC, you can access case studies with fresh, relevant content. The first one on Michelin is available on our website. The next one is due in March. A conference dedicated to digital transformation, that's Digital Futures, and the tentative dates are October 12th through the 14th in Cleveland. A facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics, updates with insights and additional resources, workshops to take deep dives on shared pain points, and webinar interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. These will always take place on the third Thursday of the month from 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Next month, we'll be talking to Brian Standen of BASF about their digital transformation. I'll be sure to sign all of you up to receive updates on the DXC. If you do not wish to receive updates, please let me know. I have a few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin our conversation with Jerry. First, this session is being recorded, and you will get a link to the recording. We will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will not be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can either raise your hand using that function on the dashboard, at which point I will unmute you so that you can ask your question, or you can type your question in and I will read it out for you. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jerry Kane. He's currently visiting scholar at the Harvard Business School, and he's also the author of The Technology Fallacy, which is available on Amazon and in bookstores. And he was a speaker at IRI's annual conference in April. So let's kick things off with a spoiler about the book. Jerry, what is the technology fallacy?
Well, you know, it's funny. The technology fallacy, when we had written the entire book, and we came up with the title last, and whereas the title really fits well with what we were talking about, we never actually define in the book what the technology fallacy is. And so since I've been presenting, I have come up with a definition of what it means. And that is, the technology fallacy is this mistaken belief that just because an organization's challenges are being caused by digital technologies, that it necessarily means that the solutions are digital as well. In our research, which basically was conducted in conjunction with MIT Sloan Management Review and Deloitte, and spanned 5 years, and we interviewed 20,000 people, we surveyed 20,000 people globally and interviewed right around 100. Some of the best responses we found to digital disruption didn't involve technology at all. One example was a large insurance company that took its standard tuition reimbursement program, and where people could go back and get degrees, and they sat down and decided, you know, determined what were 15 strategic skill sets the organization would need going forward. And if an employee pursued a degree in one of those 15 strategic areas, they would get reimbursement at 3 times the rate. So what that did was it created a steady supply of talent for the organization in topics that were digitally related, but this initiative involved no technology whatsoever. It was just a modification of existing policies. And we saw throughout our research some of the most effective responses to digital disruption were in fact not technological, but organizational, strategic, talent, leadership, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, okay. So culture is a common challenge without a common solution. So what, if any, universal truths have you found in your research?
Well, you know, I actually would say that culture is the common solution that we found in our research. The story to this is, in our research, we categorize companies according to their, what we call their digital maturity. And their digital maturity is basically, we asked respondents to imagine an ideal organization fully transformed by technology. How close does your organization meet that ideal? On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 meaning the closest match and 1 meaning farthest away. And we grouped companies according to three buckets. 1 through 3 on that scale was what we called early stage companies. 4 through 6 we called developing companies. And 7 and above we called maturing companies. And it's a nice framework. But as I was about 3 years into this research, I said to my consultant colleagues who were on the team with me, that just sounded too much like a consulting framework. We needed to do something different. Let's come up with a cultural index. And so let's figure out if there were different ways for companies to be digitally mature. Are there different types of cultures and different ways of sort of living this out? And so we came up with this cultural index, asked our 5,000 respondents that year to where their organization fit. And we conducted a statistical technique called cluster analysis, which basically takes all this data and finds, you know, big groupings of clusters, you know, that are similar to one another. And when all was said and done and we got the results back, basically the cultural index matched almost perfectly to our early developing and maturing stage categories. So my grand plan, and I even had a title in mind, which was 50 Shades of Digital Transformation, was shot because this early developing and maturing stage really seemed to be the right explanation. Now, what you need to know about the statistical technique is it doesn't use any of our maturity data at all. And so what it says is basically there is this, you know, digitally mature companies have a different culture than those of early stage or developing stages. To add to that, on the following year, when we asked, how does your organization really drive digital change? Those in the maturing organization said culture was the number one way that they drove digital transformation. So not only, and they were also more likely to be investing in initiatives to reinforce that culture. And so not only do digitally maturing companies have a different culture than early and developing stages, but they're also investing in that culture and they're using that culture to drive change. What that suggests is, you know, sort of a virtuous cycle by which you know, digitally maturing companies are using this to sort of, you know, gather momentum, and that we could see a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. Now, when companies ask me where do I start, what I suggest is, you know, I don't know what you need to start with technologies or strategies. That's going to vary by industry, but I do know you need these cultural characteristics, and that's really where I say all companies should start, because other decisions that get made may be made after you make these cultural changes.
Okay, so at the risk of asking you the question you just said you avoided with others, so, you know, what are effective ways of piecing this out into more manageable chunks? I mean, culture is just such a behemoth.
Of course. The key is to start small. So many organizations think that what you do is, you know, this massive change management initiative. And that's hard. It tends not to work. There's a higher risk of failure. And it, frankly, it just moves too slowly. Where we see a lot of companies do it is start with small innovation teams. These teams tend to be broken out and protected from other organizational bureaucracies. So we talked to the financial services firm John Hancock, you know, very old, traditional, 100-year-old organization. And they formed one small digital team that started the ball rolling. And what happened is, as they developed the culture, they did two things. They didn't keep it bottled up in this team. They moved new employees through the team to work for bits and for, you know, stretches, 6 months, 9 months, et cetera. And then as the team grew, they then split it, put members of that team to associate with other teams. And so we use the metaphor in the book, digital DNA. And we've all heard this before, you know, companies with, you know, do they have the right DNA? But specifically where we use it is in terms of gene therapy. And the way gene therapy works is you take the DNA, you splice it a little bit, not too much, not too little, And then you inject it into a cell where it then propagates itself across other cells. And that's what we see with, you know, these cultural changes. You make a small change to the DNA of a team and then use that team to sort of propagate the changes throughout the organization. It's not an organization-wide effort to start. It's really a team-by-team effort. And then you, the danger is keeping it bottled up within a team, and only the innovation teams have this. In fact, what you need to do is use the where you've cultivated these new characteristics and let them, quote unquote, infect the rest of the organization with these desired characteristics.
Okay, so what are the skill sets that you recommend organizations develop in their existing staff?
You know, it might be surprising to know that when we asked sort of what skill sets employees needed, technological skills were not the highest on the list. Really what respondents said is you need to be change oriented, you need to have a vision, you need you did need some certain technological skills, but it wasn't necessarily, hey, we need AI developers. Instead, what it is, we need people who have digital literacy, people who understand, you know, how technologies are changing the business. What was really interesting is we asked two related questions, and this the results were the same when we asked both about leadership and about talent or employees. First, we asked, to what extent did your organization have the right talent or need new talent or leadership for competing in a digital world? And almost everybody, regardless of maturity level, said we need new and better talent. In fact, between the most and the least maturing companies, the difference was only about 20%. I think it was 80% of early stage companies and 60% of maturing companies said that we need new and better talent and leaders. The big difference is what they're doing about it. There, the gap was huge. So although 80% of early stage companies said we needed better leadership, only 10% said they were doing anything about it and sort of investing in these leaders. A great example here is when I interviewed a guy named Greg Baxter, the chief digital officer of MetLife. I asked where he looks for digital leaders and digital employees. And he said, look, we're always on the lookout for good talent. Don't get me wrong. But what we really think is more important is making sure our existing employees have the right skill set to compete in the digital world. If I were to boil all of this down sort of to a key theme of our book, it's really the skill employees need is the ability to keep learning. And not just the ability, but also the time. Because something like 90% of our respondents said, I need to update my skill set at least yearly. And yet less than 45% said that their organization provided them the opportunities to do so. So there's this huge gap between I need to keep my skill set updated, but my organization isn't supporting it. And when we say supporting it, it's not through formal training initiatives. More to the point, it's through job opportunities. It's through like moving people into tours of duty, putting them on innovative projects, creating sort of, I was at Goldman Sachs 6 months ago, and they have, you know, a Goldman innovation program where employees can pitch ideas for developing new products in-house, and, you know, and 10 employees win, and they get to form their teams and develop the products they suggest with support from senior management. So it's that sort of stuff that really drives those employee skill set, not just training.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so, you know, this all kind of ties in, but you know, what organizational changes do you think are key for success here?
Well, some of it is a mindset shift. And we can come back to that in a little bit. One of the real surprising things to our research that we, a question we really dug into for a number of years. And when I presented these research at MIT's Center for Information Systems Research, their executive director, Jeannie Ross, said that this was the most insightful finding of the whole research. And that was, we were sort of surprised to find that digitally maturing companies were more likely to organize across, according to cross-functional teams. And as they did so, the structural issues they had actually went down. So we asked, to what extent do management processes and structures interfere with your ability to do business in a digital world? Cross-functional teaming went up, the barriers went down. And I asked a number of respondents why this was the case. The CIO of Harley Davidson said, well, we have to organize cross-functionally because the product is cross-functional. If we exist in silos, we can't possibly integrate digital into what we're doing. It just won't work. The chief marketing officer of Freddie Mac said, we need to organize differently to think differently. If we keep the same organization structures, we're going to keep doing things in the same way. So some of it was just mixing it up. And then Shamim Mohammed, the CIO of CarMax, said, we use cross-functional teams as an opportunity to experiment better. We task team A with project one and team two with project B. I think I just mixed my letters and numbers up there, but you're getting the point. And then we send them to work for 6 weeks, and then we evaluate their progress. And if team one on project A is seeing a lot of success, we put more resources behind it. If team B on project two is not working out so well, we task them with something else. And so it's a really good way to try a number of different things, because one of the characteristics of digital transformation that I think we all need to admit is none of us really know what we're doing. None of us know necessarily what the future is going to bring. And so the only right solution is to experiment with a number of different futures, throw some stuff against the wall and see what sticks, back those that are getting early support and kill off those that aren't. And that, you know, more creates options for the future rather than sort of having to figure out digital now before you get going with this sort of team structure. Oftentimes you figure it out as you go. Now, what was interesting about our most recent research is that these digitally mature companies were not only more likely to organize according to the cross-functional teams, they were likely to manage those teams differently. They were more likely to give these teams autonomy for making decisions. They were more likely to, what was the other one? They were more like, I'm forgetting the second one that we found. They're more likely to sort of push decision-making down, and they're more likely to evaluate the teams as a unit rather than individuals in the team. So by evaluating as a unit, it sort of incentivized them to work as a team. So those were some really interesting differences between how digitally maturing companies began to organize and structure differently for this digital world. And the result is that they could act more quickly, they could be more agile because they had individual teams that could be tasked with new projects.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So you've mentioned that in previous publications that there's research showing that there is a desire by employees to work for digitally mature companies. Why do you think that is? Isn't it obvious?
Maybe. I think the real finding for us, and this was actually a survey question on our first year of research. What was surprising to us was how strong it was and how persistent across age levels it was. So I think if we average it out, something like 80% of employees said they prefer to work for a digital leader. And when you break that down by age, yeah, there's you'd expect the millennials or the whatever the next, you know, you expect the young adults to really be digitally savvy. And in fact, you did see that there was a slight difference. I think 85% of people in their 20s wanted to work for a digitally mature company. But over like 75% of those in their 60s did. And so this was very robust with respect to age. You know, one caveat is this research was being run by MIT, a very tech-savvy group. So it may be we had some selection bias going on there. But I think repeatedly we see this millennial or this age difference driven reason for change is very much of a red herring. People across age levels really recognize the importance of digital transformation and really want to be a part of that. Another surprising thing, so it's just led to a fight on our research team with one of the team members saying, so you're telling me that employees will quit their job if they're not working for a digitally mature company. And when we did a follow-up question, we in fact found yes, those who did have opportunities would pursue those opportunities if given the chance. We asked, how likely are you to leave your organization within a year? And the difference was about 15 times more likely to want to leave their organization within a year if they were working for an early stage company versus a maturing company. And these weren't low-level leaders. In fact, the ones reporting most likely to want to leave were director and VP level, the middle management folks. So the very people your organization needs to move into the future are looking for better opportunities. Yet this difference and this desire to leave to go work for a digital leader almost entirely disappears if employees felt like they had the opportunity to develop their digital skills. So it's not that they want to work for a leader necessarily to say they work for Facebook or Google or Salesforce or whomever you want, or Walmart or Goldman. Really the trick is they want to be in a situation where they can keep their skill sets up to date. Remember our stat from a couple of questions ago, 90% of people said they need to update their skill set at least yearly, but only 45% said their organization provided those opportunities. What they're afraid of is their skills are going to atrophy and they're not going to be marketable. If you provide an environment where people can keep learning and keep growing and keep developing, they're more likely to stay with you and give it a shot because they don't fear not being employable in the future. Whereas if you just optimize on exploiting the skills that people have now, on short-term outcomes, on short-term returns, employees are going to say, I need to worry about my future. I have 10, 20, 30 years left of working life. I can't afford to let these skills atrophy. I've got to stay up to speed. So we call, talent, I don't think it ever worked its way into one of the headings, but I've always called this the Phantom Menace, revealing my Star Wars fandom. That this talent, potential talent drain is the real phantom menace of digital transformation, because what can happen if you aren't progressing digitally, your employees don't have their skill set, the right skill sets, they're going to start leaving to go to some place where they can, and it's not going to be your best employees that are leaving or your worst employees that are leaving, it's going to be your best, and then you might not have the resources in-house to sort of make the changes you need to make. So I think talent is sort of a really important strategic factor when it comes to digital transformation.
All right, yeah, I could definitely see that, and I think a lot of our members are seeing that too. So based on what you've learned so far, what recommendations do you have for companies on their journey?
I think the first one is just get started. There's a lot, we asked what was the biggest, how does your company approach digital transformation? Early stage companies say they walk, it's mostly talk. They don't actually do anything. They talk digital, they don't make any changes. Developing companies really approach digital transformation as one-off initiatives. So they're doing digital things, they're doing digital experiments, but they're not necessarily using it to drive the core business. Digitally maturing companies are really working at integrating digital into their core business proposition. And there's a real risk, and this is, my favorite findings are ones that sort of go against the hypothesis I had going in. The hypothesis I had going in was that digitally mature companies were going to experiment more than early stage companies. And in fact, that's not what we found. What we found was that everybody experiments, or people are more than happy to experiment with digital transformation. The ones that are really being successful are the ones that are using these successful experiments to drive change across the organization. We always hear, you know, fail fast or fail early. What we call it in the book is fail fast, learn faster, and have the courage to succeed. Because really the key of digital transformation is starting to experiment, and then when you have successful experiments, use that to drive change across the organization. Because if not, John Hagel, the director of Deloitte Center to the Edge, you know, said that everybody has an innovation lab in Silicon Valley. To say they have an innovation lab in Silicon Valley, but the unspoken rule is that innovation lab never comes back and affects the core business. And that's what needs to happen. That's sort of rethinking the very business proposition in light of digital transformation. That's where success comes, and that's where the digitally maturing companies really differentiate themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just going to do a quick plug for the Michelin case study too, because they're a great example of that. That's something that they're working on too.
Awesome.
So, yeah. So it does work. So we're going to open the floor for questions now. And while you all mull all of this over, I've got one more question for Jerry. So again, referencing the Michelin case study, you've incorporated the fixed versus growth mindset idea into your work. And we also saw that Michelin used this to a certain degree in their organization. Can you talk about how this impacts organizations' digital journey?
Yeah, so we always had been operating with this sort of idea. So Carol Dweck talks about the fixed versus growth mindset. For those who aren't familiar with it, fixed mindset basically is the belief that your success is a result of your inherent characteristics. And sort of success is really built in or baked in. Whereas growth mindset says success is a result of hard work and effort. You know, that I am successful because I've really worked at developing these skills and becoming successful. You're very popular in the educational literature as what differentiates people that are successful versus not. And in the last year of our research, we actually asked two questions in conjunction with one another. We asked, to what extent is your organization going to be in better or worse, or is your organization going to be a better or worse shape going forward as a result of digital trends? And then we asked an open-ended question of why. So those who said that they were going to be in a stronger position going forward invariably said, the reason why, so stronger, they said, because we're going to develop the digital capabilities we need to succeed. Those who said we're going to be in a worse position, they're going to be in a worse position because of market forces. Nothing screams growth versus fixed mindset to me more than that result, because those who are successful, we can do this, we're going to develop what we need, and those who are going to fail or it's, oh, well, we can't do anything because of the market. The market's working against us. It's just something that's external. And then you hear it in their talk too. We're not a digital organization. I'm not a tech savvy person. We're a legacy company. We can't do that. Those are all fixed mindset statements. You may be a legacy company, but I've seen some amazing legacy companies make some extremely successful transformations. You know, I will confess, when I first interviewed Walmart about their digital transformation efforts, I said, there is no way an old, stodgy, conservative company like Walmart can possibly make the changes they're going to need to make. They're just too big. It's not going to work. And then as I got in and started talking to them, they were really making some amazing progress. And keep in mind, I talked to them about 5 years ago. Now we know that they've acquired Jet.com, and they're doing all sorts of interesting things and really becoming a viable competitor to Amazon. 5 years ago, we had all written them off and saying, okay, they are the old economy. And Walmart has made some amazing changes And I would argue if a company, if the Fortune 1 company can do, well, first, if the Fortune 1 company needs to, thinks it needs to change, we all need to change. And then point two is if they can do it, we all can do it. Because, you know, they have just as many challenges and issues as the most, you know, staid company. And yet they have been making some really remarkable changes, and they've been making remarkable changes because they're looking at a long time frame. They looked 10 years out and said, hey, if we stay on the path we're on, people aren't going to shop in the same way in 10 years. We need to make that change. And I wonder how many companies on the call today actually have sat down with their leadership and say, okay, what's our industry going to look like in 10 years, and what do we need to do to respond? So that's a great way for companies to start, you know, thinking about what they need to do. And then I recommend, are you going to get that? So whenever I give that advice, I get laughed at, I get scoffed. Kane, how can we possibly know, successfully predict what the industry is going to look like? And my response is, it doesn't matter if you get it right. It matters is if you're starting to think this way, because often when you project out 10 years, you get a better sense of the significance of the technological change that we're facing. And so you'll do more stuff. And then I also recommend it as a 10-year roll, like redo this every year, so that you're keeping your eye on the horizon. And if you get an off or things change, you can adapt to that change. So absurdly long-term strategic planning is what I call it. And I really recommend that all organizations engage in that at least yearly to make sure they're seriously considering how digital disruption is going to affect their industry.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you. We've actually had our first question come in. So what are the common pitfalls for digital transformation? Do you see differences between different industries?
That's a good question. You know, I really didn't, we sort of intentionally kept this industry agnostic, so we could keep the broadest possible audience. And I do think a number of our lessons, like the focus on culture, the focus on leadership and talent, the focus on strategy, you know, is pretty industry agnostic. You know, as I presented it around, you know, and I did IRI annual meeting back in April. And since then, like every new group I have spoken to, I said, okay, surely this group is not going to be interested in what I have to say. I went to a large HVAC manufacturer. I went to a conference of rural electric cooperative CEOs. I spoke with someone in poultry management, and I'll tell you that question in a little bit, or that story. And then I went to, you know, a corporate innovation workshop. It's like, okay, these people, so the first group is like, oh, surely they're not being digitally disrupted or they're not concerned about it. All of those people were and had interesting stories to tell that I had never thought of or dealt with before. On the other end of the spectrum, the corporate innovation people are dealing with many of the same things. I thought that group would say, oh, we already know all this stuff. And they don't. You know, I'm going to, they're flying me to, one corporate innovation team is bringing me out to Germany to deal with, to help their group sort of become more digitally enabled. And so all of these groups, you know, we're talking about pitfalls. So there's similarities, I think, between industries. Some of the pitfalls, I think, are these mindset shifts. Are the fact that we don't think we can do it. We tend to start too big. We tend to think we don't approach it with enough intensity. We don't carve enough time off to do it. So this year we asked, to what extent, basically how often do you get to innovate within your job? And the magic number between those who were sort of progressing and those who were not was right around 10%. So a little can go a long way. I'm not sort of suggesting here that everybody sort of develop a skunk works for digital transformation. But I do think 10% is probably within the goal, or even 5% within the, achievable for most organizations. Give people 5% of their time to continue developing new skills and trying new things. So I think the biggest challenges are, you know, the belief that we can't do it, the belief that we don't need to do it, and the belief that it's, you know, what sort of work it's going to take. The third thing, I don't even know, I say third, I don't even know if I'd put a first or a second, so I'm just sort of throwing out numbers now. An additional problem, I get excited about this stuff, I'm sorry. The second biggest pitfall is, I think, going back to the title of the technology fallacy. So I was doing a podcast similar to this one, and he opened it up for questions. And we talked for 40 minutes about strategy and culture and talent. And then he comes back with me and says, okay, so what should a digitally mature company's cloud strategy be? And my response is, you have missed the entire point. We always want to bring digital technology or digital transformation back to the technologies. And I really believe, and so many companies start with the technology. Oh, we need to be in AI. Oh, we need to be in blockchain. Oh, we need to be in data and analytics. They go technology first, which then you're trying to build your business strategy around the technology you bought, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm shocked at how often managers fall into the shiny new toy trap. Whereas I think what we need to stay laser focused on is these talent, these strategy, these culture, these structural issues. And then once we figure out what sort of changes we want to make, what sort of goals we have, what sort of culture we want, then we build in the technology after we've started to make all of these changes, because our technological choices may turn out to be very different once we begin these other organizational process of other organizational changes.
All right, and before we move to the next question, I'm going to need you to circle back and tell us the poultry story, because I think there was something interesting.
Oh, yeah. So the funny thing is, this has been my go-to story for 6 months now. And then I went to the rural electric cooperatives, and they said, this doesn't surprise us at all. You know, the farmers that are left are all hugely digitally transformed. So I had a friend. This is the fun thing about being a college professor, is now, I used to live in Atlanta, now I live in Boston. And all of my friends are now having college age kids, and they're all coming up on college tours. And so I get to see, you know, kids I haven't seen in 15 years, all grown up, coming to look at colleges, et cetera, et cetera. And so one of them came to my class, and I knew he was in IT. And I said, hey, you want to talk to my class for 10 minutes and tell them what you do? And I said, I didn't exactly know. So he gets up there and he starts talking about how he is in poultry management software. And so what this is basically is software for chicken farmers. Because unbeknownst to me, so when chicken farmers have a contract with like KFC, they have incentives to grow a certain size of bird, because, you know, fast food wants standardized product. The way to get standardized product is to make sure you grow standardized chickens. And so their software helps people, helps chicken farmers raise chickens of the right size. They need more food, they need less, they need more light, they need less, et cetera, et cetera. And so I said, oh, great. You know, not only do people in Boston think everybody from the South is a redneck, but now I am reinforcing this by bringing in the poultry farm. But then he said, we've been building this software for 20 years. He said, 6 months ago, we tried an experiment by putting in artificial intelligence into our software. And he said, 6 months later, the AI approach is now outperforming 20 years worth of our intellectual property within 6 months on a weekend project. And you know, all the folks there were just sort of dumbstruck. And I said, I told my MBA students, the takeaway here is you go back to your boss and say the chicken farmers are more digitally transformed than we are. We need to get our act in gear. And so it becomes this really powerful story. The stories I like the most are the ones you would never think about. We all think about Facebook and Google and yada, yada, yada. But digital disruption is hitting the chicken farmers as well. And think about any competing poultry software out there. You know, this market could be disrupted within the course of about 6 months to a year because this one company started with an AI approach and the competitors didn't. And we've seen this sort of speed. The hearing aid industry with additive manufacturing was disrupted over the course of about 18 months. If you waited past those 18 months to adopt additive manufacturing, your company basically went out of business. And those who did it first and was in that 18-month window took over the market. We've also seen that. I heard a similar story amongst medical prosthetic industries with 3D printing. And so we hear these sort of stories in these very unexpected places of digital disruption, like completely upending an industry. And so it's affecting everybody, I think.
All right. And thank you. So I've got one from Jerry Grunewald. And so I'm going to read it out. And then Jerry's got his hand raised, too. So I'm going to unmute you, Jerry, so that you can ask any follow-up questions that you have. So let me read this out. So can you say more about your concept of technology affordances, how new technology can afford new capabilities? And I'm going to unmute you, Jerry. So if you've got loud noise in the background, remute yourself, please. Okay.
So Jerry has read the book clearly because we didn't talk about it here today. I love it. You know, it's funny. One of my co-authors, I introduced this concept of affordances, which has been around the academic literature for about 15 or 20 years or longer. And one of my consultants, just consultant co-authors, all three of my co-authors are Deloitte partners, just loved it. It's like, why aren't we talking about this? I mean, it hasn't quite caught on. You know, he was trying to sell it. And he said, I can't get people to share my excitement with it. So I'll put him in touch with Jerry because Jerry likes it. It's a very simple concept. It's, you know, affordances, it actually goes back. There's a whole history of it in the book where it comes from. But the lesson here is it's not what the technology doesn't have value in and of itself. The technology is valuable by what it enables individuals and companies to do. Now, that may sound sort of simple, but so often we sort of buy the technologies and expect it to fix whatever it is the problem is that we're having in this organization. But more to the point is these affordances have a couple of implications. One, my colleague Paul Leonardi at UC Santa Barbara has developed the concept of shared affordances. And basically what he says is the certain types of technology, namely things like Slack and collaboration platforms, are not going to have an impact unless you're all using it in the same way to change the way you work. This is why a lot of these collaboration platforms haven't caught on, is everybody still has access to email and continues to use email, and it can't get a foothold. And so as a group, we need to use it collectively. There are certain things called false affordances, whereas, you know, we put in the technology and think they're going to have an impact, and in fact, they don't, because they don't actually allow us to interact. They just basically sort of, they don't change the way we can interact with our competitive environment as individuals or as organizations. And so it's this moving away from this concept of what the technology does and change it to what does the technology allow us as an organization to do. And the third one we talk about is progressive affordances, because once you have technology in place and are using it for your base level functions, you often find that new capabilities can be added onto it. And I would argue progressive affordances are really actually describing the AI initiative or the AI development now, because the original affordance was data. And so let's collect digital data so we could analyze it better. Now, once we're collecting all this digital data, that's what we could say, oh, and if we apply AI on top of this new electronic data resource, it allows us to open up all sorts of new things. So I would argue that AI is actually a progressive, it's providing progressive affordances. Once we're collecting the data, That's level one. Then we can sort of think of very new ways to automate, to filter information, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that helps or if Jerry has a follow-up question.
No, that's great. That was enormously helpful.
Thank you.
All right. And so we have a couple more questions. One is, with regards to CISR, they orthogonalize the problem along two axes, namely customer experience versus digitization of internal processes. Could you comment on what would be a good place to start and focus on?
Oh, that's a great question. And CISR does, that's the MIT center that I had presented this research to, and they do some really amazing stuff. So a lot of their work tends to be with CIOs and sort of the IT function, whereas our book tends to deal a little more with, you know, technology for everybody. And so I would say, you know, I actually think customer focus, and so disclaimer, they're really smart people doing some really great, doing a ton of really great stuff. I actually think the emphasis on customer centricity is actually overdone in a lot of the digitalization literature. My reason for doing this, so I was able to interview the chief human relations officer of Disney. And he said, we have a real problem because we're great. Disney, if you've ever been to Walt Disney World and used their magic bands, which are based in RFID technology, it's the single most effective money vacuum I've ever seen. And as a business, as a father, I'm horrified. As a business school professor, I'm in awe of how well they do this. But he said, but we're really terrible at using digital to interact with our employees. And the problem now is our employees, we're not compared to basically Universal Studios or competitors. We're compared to Google and to Facebook. People are used to having a seamless digital experience, which we can provide to our customers, but we don't apply it to our own employees. And so what they say is, you know, he said, it's easier to apply for a job outside the organization than inside the organization. It's easy. He said the only restaurant where our employees can't order food using a mobile app is our own internal commissary. He said, this is a problem when we don't function well internally. And so I think customer centricity is really important. And that's, you know, I'm not discounting that, but I also think we are discounting the use of these tools to sort of drive change within the organization. And so that's, you know, I would say just keep that balance. And so if you are sort of focusing on customer centricity, you know, make sure you also focus internally on your own employees and their performance and their ability to interact with each other digitally. I'm not sure if that, I don't see the questions in front of me, so I'm not sure if that answered it, or feel free to come back if you want to follow up.
All right, and we've got time for one more, I think. He says thank you. So I think you answered his question. What culture do digitally mature companies have?
So what we did was, I realized I hadn't gone into that. I'd have to look it up to remember exactly what was in the index. But ones that jump out at me are ones that a lot of companies wrestle with are risk tolerance. Sort of when, you know, because we built in a time, especially if you're in a manufacturing industry, Six Sigma was the mantra 20 years ago. You know, get it down to, you know, virtually zero error rate. And it's hard to be, that's fine in an environment where conditions are fairly stable. That's really hard to do in an environment where conditions are changing and you're having to learn new ways of doing business. It's hard to learn, you learn more from failures than you do from successes. And so cultivating that right amount of risk tolerance is really key. We interviewed one executive who really flipped it on its head. He said, we have a target risk, failure rate, say 5%. He said, and the problem is if we do better than that, it means we're not being risky enough. So they were actually using failure rate to try riskier and more aggressive projects, which I thought was a really interesting way to approach things. Agility is another key, is how do we start responding more quickly to our environment, and what sort of changes do we need to make? And that, you know, goes hand in hand with the organizational structure, the team-based structure, but some of it is, you know, that change, you know, it needs to be this culture of decision-making. Because, and what we've seen is, as we try to push decision-making further down into the organization, the people who are most, again, a hypothesis I had was that management didn't want to give up power. They didn't want to push decision-making down because they didn't want to give up the control of the authority. In fact, what we found was a more of a problem was these team leaders and these lower level managers are more reluctant to step up and make strategic decisions when necessary. You know, because you don't get fired for not making a decision when you don't make a strategic decision. And so creating this environment and this culture where people are empowered. In my previous job, in my previous career, this was called a permission giving organization. So you empower people to sort of do things, to change things within reason. Communication is really key. Once you decouple, once you're more agile, communication becomes, and casting the right vision becomes extremely important, because people need to know where they stand. You know, ethics and sort of the company, you know, company vision and values are critically important. Again, Greg Baxter at MetLife, he said, people mistakenly think, he said, I compared ethics to brakes on a car. He said, people misunderstand what brakes are for. They think brakes are there to slow down the car. He said, no, brakes are there to let the car go fast, because you can go faster if you have confidence that you have the ability to slow down when needed. And he said, that's the role of ethics and values in an organization. You can go faster, you can be more agile when you have the confidence that your employees know right from wrong, know what the values are, and can put on the brakes when necessary. So it's these sorts of things. This more collaborative is another factor. More collaborative, more agile, more risk tolerant. Those sorts of things are the things that really define these digitally maturing companies. And then once those things are in place, you figure out how technology fits into that and how you're going to use technology in terms of affordances to let you do business differently. And that's where you buy and implement the new technologies. Once you've figured out, once you've gotten the culture in place, once you figure out how you want to behave differently, and it's only, technology is only stage three.
All right, I'm going to try and sneak in one last question. We have one just come in from Sammy Mardino from USG. For a legacy building product company starting small with digital transformation, could you provide insights around establishing metrics for customer-facing digital initiatives that are not products in and of themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not sure I have an easy answer to that. Instead, I'll tell a story, and that's, so we did some work with Volvo. So Volvo, legacy manufacturing company, and so they created, you know, it was a two-year process by which they figured out what those things were going to be. And they had a digital task force. They were trying to create connected cars. So what's really interesting, so I'll answer this question with a data point that doesn't get talked about much in the book. We asked the question, who's driving your digital initiatives? And sort of it starts with IT, but as companies get more mature, it really gets into the CIO's office or the CEO's office. It's driven from the top. The boss drives the digital transformation. The only one that increases in importance over the core as companies mature is also product management. When you don't know where to start and you are a product-driven company, and this is what Volvo did, they came up with a connected car initiative and they started for 2 years figuring out how would we deliver this product. And then when they started figuring out how they needed to deliver their product, whether it's metrics, whether it's innovation, whether it was contracting, they really realized they needed to approach developing this product very differently than they did their traditional, you know, auto manufacturing. And so I do think a viable approach, particularly for manufacturing companies, it says, we don't know how, let's get a team together to figure out what digital product, but how we would go about developing a digital product. What roadblocks are we going to come in? What issues are we going to run into? And in the process of figuring it out, you end up digitally transforming your company because you start saying, okay, we need to, like, so Volvo, they realized they had a contracting approach for their traditional suppliers, which was very manufacturing based because, okay, we got a seat or a mirror from this company, it's very clear. When they started to partner with Spotify, and Spotify wasn't, they weren't actually paying Spotify for this, but they were having to integrate it and they wanted the product, they had to come up with an entirely new way of contracting with Spotify to be able to work with them. And it was in that process of figuring out the pragmatic problems that were associated with developing a digital product or a product for a digital world that they figured out what sort of processes they needed around it. So in some senses, you reverse engineer your digital organization by trying to put out a digital product and figuring out what changes, what works, what doesn't. And you know, it'll take time, but that's how you figure out what sort of changes. And that goes back to the what metrics are necessary. I don't know. But if as you start putting together a digital product, it may then become apparent as you start working on and trying to pragmatically solve that problem.
All right, just in the wire. That was awesome. Thank you. So thanks to everyone for all their questions, and a big thank you to Jerry Kane today for giving us his time and agreeing to be interviewed and grilled by all of us. So remember to join us on February 20th for our next interview with Brian Standen of BASF. The recording, the podcast of this will be available shortly. I'll make sure it gets out to everyone. And thank you and have a great day. And a big thank you again to Jerry.
Thanks, everyone.